try to steer away them in this treatment of love from the cheapness which surrounds it today. You call love usually sex. You don't believe that for the love of Christ one could do great things. Yet the whole business of Christianity, of course, is based on the assumption that love is the power to nominate people, to give them a new name. So the word nomination is perhaps even more to the point as naming. And I want you very much to think for the rest of your life on this problem of incest seriously. That we know what incest is not because some doctor says us it isn't good, inbreeding isn't good, but because we all know this before there's any science and any doctor, that we cannot love with full power somebody who had already a mild name of friendship in our neighborhood. Somebody who has already been something else cannot be, you see, with full power the new love. Once you have understood this, gentlemen, I think you should be in a way immune against these incredible confusions of purely physical processes and the power that overcomes any man who has a great privilege of being loved. You are a different person because in one other person's mind you appear under a name which nobody else yet recognizes, but which they do. The whole gospel, as you've written, is written as a love story when one after the other of the faithful just gives Jesus the appropriate name as Christ. When even Thomas finally falls down, the church is founded. And that's the whole story. But Peter is the first to recognize him as the Messiah, and Thomas is, so to speak, the last, and that's the whole content of the gospel. And the whole expansion into the pagan world of Christianity came about by one man, you see, suddenly hearing the Lord saying, "Paul, Paul, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" That is, why don't you give me the name whom you know, which you know very well, belongs to me? It is all, gentlemen, these power processes, they go on in our community every minute. That if you are forced to call an admired man your friend, or you are the hero, that in this moment there's order in the world. Now, in order to set this out a little more straightforward, gentlemen, I want you to consider the worship of work and the worship of love. In which way do we worship this sphere of work? As you know, today people not only treasure money, but there's another way of worshiping work, by overwork. But the overwork in America, as you know, has a very special way of expressing itself. It's called organization. We have today not only administrations and deans of administration, we have even coordinators, as you know. The whole country is absolutely crazy with the idea that you have to worship work by organizing it all the time. It's a craze. It's an insanity. America is at this moment spending one half of its time and its millions on organizing, on filing cabinets. 16 forms have to be filled out whenever one naval application or letter is written. 16 times the same thing is filed away. It's absolute insanity, gentlemen, but everybody in this country is proud of, because the god of work is ruling. Laugh it out of court. I mean, it's absolutely silly, these 16 copies. They should all be destroyed, and the typewriters and the filing cabinets with it. But we are one, I mean, we are so proud of it. Who writes English papers in the English department? Well, you know what they have, 54 little formulas at the end how to censor your, mark your paper, you remember? 54, I counted them. That's organization. Organization, gentlemen, today is the worship of work. It is absolutely childish, and most of you will fall for it, and you will all become organizers, administrators, assistant to the dean or something like that. Empty straw. That's all there is to it. Because it's the worship of work. Gentlemen, work is there to make you free for love. But it is not there to be multiplied in itself. And once you try to multiply work what you call organizing it and sitting down and making 54 marks, it is put between the professor of English and you, just this organization. And instead of telling you are an ass or an idiot, you have these wonderful remarks. S means slang and P means punctuation and T means tried. It dispenses with your real relation between teacher and student. It's between you, the organization, always. All that's what I'm driving at this gentleman, not to scold or to run, but to make you aware that all organization tries to make impersonal. Work is unnamed, unrecognized, and impersonal within any organization. In the Civil Office Service of England, which is a very good service, as you know, there always has been pointed out that there must be unrecognized service. That is, people in an organization have to work without getting individual and personal recognition. So you see, there's something inevitable in the grandeur and in the tragedy of organizations. It is impersonal. Today, however, in this country, the God is Jupiter, the God is organization, gentlemen. And people in this country prefer impersonal relations to personal relations. In this whole college, or every college, all my colleagues think it is advantageous to have a non-personal relation to the student, a replaceable relation, that anybody can give a course. The same course, you see. One is sick, you see. I don't know that gives a course. Is this possible in any personal teaching? It's impossible. But it is done here all over the place. That's why my course has a number, you see, as though somebody else could give this course. Perfectly jolly. You see, it's 40. That's organization. So you can very clearly see, gentlemen, that in a college where the courses have numbers, the idea is that the name is it's an inflection, an addition, which is not necessary. Names are unnecessary for the structure of this college at this moment, you see. You have need one president, and the rest are numbers. And it's the same with you. You prefer organization to personal connection. It's too dangerous, gentlemen. In this modern world, the only sphere where people become personal and confident is on the railroad, because they are quite sure that they never meet their neighbor again, so they confide all their crimes to the neighbor on the next seat. Otherwise, we remain impersonal. That is, we have really been able in our organized society, gentlemen, to put things on, stand them on their head. We are personal where we are quite sure that we will never see the person again. And we remain impersonal where we are afraid that for the rest of our life we may be plagued with their presence. So we better don't become ever personal, because that's too vulnerable. You see, this may wound somebody and may leave scars. You live in a highly depersonalized world. General GI, is the expression, you see, for this organization of the army. What does it mean? Well, general issue, you see, expendable. Gentlemen, wherever you have affection, nomination, the word organization cannot take place. Therefore, you always have the organization of the Republican Party, or the Democratic Party, or the Progressive Party in need for a big name. Mr. Harriman has to come in, or Mr. Eisenhower, because the Republican Party is just an organization. And that wouldn't do. You can't win votes with an organization, because votes go for names. But you can work hard as a Republican Party, and they did, because they are an organization. Gentlemen, in this country, you must stick to the great wisdom of the last 150 years of this republic, that the political machine, which is just another word for organization, you see, must always have a living name in addition in order to win. It is impossible to have an election, you see, organized by the machine and won by the machine. There is one item that must transcend the machine, the name Woodrow Wilson, or the name F.D. Roosevelt, or the name Eisenhower, were chosen by the machine in due respect to the opinion of mankind, that machines are not to be elected or voted for, or to arouse any passions. Anybody who gets hot under the collar for the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, is a very immature person, gentlemen, because that's just an organization. And an organization never deserves to be loved. It is made to exclude love. It's its purpose, because it is a purposive organization, gentlemen. Every organization is a means to an end, gentlemen, and means cannot be loved. Every organization is a means to an end. Can you see this? Therefore, it cannot be loved. We can only love, gentlemen, such creatures who are the last instance of being and not some preliminary step. Means are all preliminary to reality. But a baby, gentlemen, has no finality, no aim beyond itself. No baby has a purpose. And I'm glad to say you have no purpose. That is, I like you regardless of your stupid purposes. If I would like you because of your purposes, we would found a party and organize. That's one thing, you see. But I like you just the same. Whether I disapprove of your purposes or not, you see, doesn't make any difference. This you cannot see. The boy who asked me the famous question, what do I gain by the good life, believed in the third sphere. Gentlemen, you don't gain anything by the good life, because in the good life, every creature that occurs there is an end in himself. You have no end beyond yourself, I hope. You have an immortal soul. Now, what more can you ask? Immortality means that you are the last end. Of course, you don't believe that you're an immortal soul. But if you could, this would just be another expression for having found that you are not a mean to an end. And nobody else is. So you belong into the fourth sphere. But in power of what? Obviously, gentlemen, in the fourth sphere, all the terms by which we are labeled instruments or tools must fall. Otherwise, we remain in the sphere of being just mean. For example, GI is not good enough for you and me as a final title. Then you must become General Patton, or the famous corporal on Incorregidor. That is, you must acquire fame, name it, reputation, something that nobody else has. Therefore, this whole process of nomination or naming is something by which we emerge from the mere organization. I told you the last time, I remember, that species was the way in which value or irreplaceability knocked at the door of nature. That an elephant had to be called an elephant is such a wonderful animal. Everybody admires them, you see. But we say 10 elephants, 50 elephants, 5 elephants, because beneath the elephant we hardly go. If you have a tame elephant, you may call him Jumbo. And then Jumbo is, again, you see, the last name. Wherever we put a name, we are in the fourth sphere. But wherever anything can be classified by one name, we are in the sphere still of purpose and means. 10 elephants can work hard, you see. Jumbo is a pet elephant. So he already becomes human. He becomes invaluable, you see. He cannot be just put to work as a means to an end. So it's with all our pet animals. They are borderline cases. I mean, the dog and your horse and your cat. They are, when you give them a name and when you mourn when they die, they have already entered, you see, the sphere, can you see this, of something irreplaceable. But with human beings, gentlemen, it is very hard for you to understand that at every moment we are partly organized and partly beyond the organization. I am one of innumerable professors of colleges in this land. As such, I'm just a means to an end for giving other people instruction and education. You see? I have to tolerate this. And the more I tolerate this, I mean, the more I, so to speak, connive with this conspiracy of taking away my personality in this sphere, the more I may hope to rescue it. It's no use arguing. I'm just organized away into this mainstream of college professors. There's even now an association of college professors, etc. But as such, gentlemen, that's minor. All my organized elements, that you belong to a fraternity, gentlemen, that you belong to a family, that you belong to the United States, that you are resident of Norfolk, Virginia, all these are minor parts of you. This is not the main thing. And we have, therefore, to study these spheres. That's why do I invite you to be serious about these spheres? Because we all are part of this, and part of life, and part of work and organization. But the more careful you distinguish what part of you has to stay within these things, the more free you will be for being also a member of the fourth and the fifth sphere, of where the mentality begins to exist. And I assure you, inside an organization, he is far from existing. He's just a boundary warrior, or one of the many sub-programmers of Soviet Union. And they can be investigated statistically. What's the average doctor earning? That he has not been the doctor, you see, who has a special fiancé, you see, and is quite a prison. So this division between the third and the fourth sphere today is really beclouded, because I think that for the last 20 years, as far as I can see it, America has plunged for organization. If you think that today a barber has to have a college education, and a dentist has to have a board examination, and on it goes, the country is crazy with organization. We now introduce very rapidly a guild and craft system, compared with which the medieval craft system and guild system is just nothing. If you think that a man has to study for the 33rd year before he may call himself a surgeon, it's just fantastic. 20 years ago, you could still be one of the most distinguished lawyers and never have gone to law school. At 19, you read the law at home, you see, and at 20, you called yourself a lawyer. And at 21, you betrayed everybody else and excelled in that. That is, gentlemen, in 20 years, this country has given up all improvisation and is organizing. And you can decide that's good. I don't want to criticize it, but you must know it. Gentlemen, it's a phase of life which is not necessary. It is just so at this moment in this country. And I think three-quarters of it is absolute insanity in my public estimation. No human being that comes to this country is treated, as you know, they have now, they put them in jail now when they land. All humanity is gone. They announced the closing of Ellis Island as a humanitarian measure, and in fact it's the most cruel brutality, because the men who now cannot be brought to Ellis Island has to be brought into a jail at the battery. And that's America, a humanitarian Christian country. And nobody says anything. You are not interested. You have much more important problems of organizing your fraternity. You organize all day long. Everybody organizes. Gentlemen, every step in organization takes away from your humanity. You must know this. The people who organize feed their conscience on the third level of the Jupiter level. Aren't we purposive? Aren't we economical? Aren't we rational beings? Certainly. But why are you? Why do you waste your energy why do you channelize your energy into this field? Because you don't dare to learn. That's too vulnerable. That's too exciting. That's too dangerous. And then you can go wrong. With organizational, actually, I mean, have you seen the concert? The opera? See? Have you seen it? Well, it's all there, isn't it?
Anybody who hasn't seen or the records of the concert or the play itself, the opera, should really listen to it, gentlemen. It's the greatest piece of art of our period. It's great, I think. I don't care for the execution, because a man has dared into a sphere which has not yet been conceived as a tragic part of our existence. And it is the most tragic part of our present day existence. This being organized, you see, and ceasing to be anything. Happens in Russia, happens in America. All the Europeans say, what's the choice? America is just as bad as Russia in this respect. Everybody is filed away. Everybody has an IQ. Everybody has 82% or 77% of something. And the Europeans say, we never heard of such a thing. I'm not 57%. I'm not 140. I have not blood pressure 125. I mean, I'm not interested in being organized. You see? Have you seen, oh, So Green Is My Valley? Well, Mr. Priestley, the author, you see, wrote a very wonderful lamentation as an inhabitant of this green valley, and said, now I am asked to choose between America and Russia, and I really find no difference, absolute no distinction. America is just as boring and as organizable as Russia. What's the difference? I want to escape both. And he's a very good man, and he knows what he's talking about, gentlemen, and you don't even know it, and you are bored stiff. You see, anybody who's organized ceases to be interesting. Organized people are boring. All trade unions are so boring. All chambers of commerce are so boring. All golf clubs are so boring. They're all organized. Everything is predictable. Gentlemen, what's organization? Making things predictable. And as soon as you are predictable, gentlemen, nobody cares for you. You cannot love a predictable person. Will you kindly take this down, gentlemen? It's very important for you to know. You cannot live a predictable person. And why can't you, gentlemen? You can't trust her. You can't trust any predictable person, because for any unexpected emergency, such a predictable person is no good. You see, I must have a wife who can emigrate with me to the North Pole. If she were predictable, then she would only be able to move in set ways. But I know that she is absolutely indifferent to all routines and set ways of life. Therefore, she will follow me to the ends of the world. Your wife will not. She will say, I have to stay in Scottsdale, New York. I cannot live in another region. And she will even prescribe to you what kind of candles she will have to have on the table, and all these things. More and more of these young women, in their desperation, become organized fanatics too. They think they have to have doilies on the table, and they have to have candlelight on the table, and they have to have a certain set of television. All these is all nonsense. You have to have nothing if you love. Absolutely nothing. And once they begin to think in those terms, they become so boring, these women. And the more diamonds you buy them, the more boring they are. The diamonds may be very interesting, but not the carrier, the bearer. The only person, gentlemen, who's interesting is an incalculable person. Because you can't calculate her by any standards of organization. This is all heresy to you, I know. But I at least want to have to tell you, gentlemen, why there is so very little love and so many shepherds in this country. There's no, why shouldn't they? These people all die from exhaustion of their love faculty. They are all impotent in the deepest sense. They may have as many physical successes as they can, gentlemen. Most Don Juans, most people who have to sleep with a woman 10 times a day, are impotent, spiritually impotent. That's why they have to be Don Giovanni's. Any sober person, gentlemen, who can write a poem for his sweetheart and hear the name with him, she calls him, is satisfied. The only way in which you can acquire the quest of your body, gentlemen, is by fulfilling your thirst for being named. Then all these passions suddenly die. That's why a monk or a nun, gentlemen, who is named with a new name when they enter the monastery, have relatively very little fight or little very temptation about sex. Because they are just taken seriously that they are named to a new position. I had a friend who was put on the index of Rome as a Catholic priest. He was a great writer. And he said, as soon as I was excommunicated by Rome, I had to marry. Because as a priest, he was 50. I had never any trouble. My congregation loved me. They called me father. Such a man doesn't have to have intercourse with women or doesn't have to marry. But when this broke down and these people were my enemies, I had to belong somewhere. So he married and has 4 children. That's all very simple, gentlemen, but it is so simple that nobody tells you. You have separated sex and speech so totally that you don't know that this sex without speech is sin, without naming, and speech without love is sin. We speak in order to make love, but we do not, as you think, we are not free to use our body in separation from our total man. You are not your body, gentlemen. Your body is one element of your existence. And if you want to learn who man is, you must only know how easy it is when you are in desperation and feel you must get drunk or must have some orgy. You meet on the street some nice girl and she says, hello, John, you're cured for the whole day. Everybody knows this. One smile, one friendly gesture can cure the wildest and most infuriated, most passionate heart. This one name is enough to put him right. Isn't that true? Why don't you observe any facts? You go to laboratories to observe what you can know every day yourself. You can make no experience, gentlemen. That's your worst trouble. You don't trust your own experiences. Otherwise, you would know this relation of name and poetry and writing poetry, and you wouldn't stop writing poetry at the age of 12. You would know that you have to write verse now. And since you don't do it, you can't love. Because love is just simply, gentlemen, the application of your power to speak. And vice versa. Because in love, we communicate in such a way that we make sure that we belong, are partners of a larger alliance. Or as Mr. Mont-de-France of the radio said, alliance. Love, gentlemen, what is love? Suddenly seeing oneself inside a larger body. That is love. Seeing oneself suddenly within a larger body. Because you don't do justice to your sweetheart if you just want to devour her and eat her up. If you love her, you want to place her together with you within one larger group, for example, a family. That is love. Therefore, love is not idolatry. You must not idolize your wife, but she and you must have a common faith. Inside the same temple, the same sanctuary, the same cosmos, you must begin to live and to move as partners, as members. Therefore, gentlemen, there is no possibility of loving love between husband and wife without some relation to the name above both of you. You have to live in the name of the God which rules your marriage. It can be passion, it can be Christ, it can be Yahweh, it can be Jupiter, it can be some God. But all married people, all people who speak to each other, gentlemen, invoke some name above their alliance, to whom both their speeches remain related. You must, after all, if you write a letter to your sweetheart, she must believe you in the name of love, in the name of truth, in the name of God, in the name of the United States, in the name of patriotism. But some power must make you speak to her so that she knows what you mean. You don't know all this. It's all destroyed in our wrong teaching in schools, I'm afraid, because we live in a rational and purposive society where all words have become advertisements for selling toothpaste. Gentlemen, we don't speak for selling things. We don't speak for communicating facts. We only speak for nominating each other into membership into some common group. That's why we speak. By speech, you and I begin to believe that we really form niches and parts inside something that must be built up out of us. Some superstructure, or structure I should really say, some common house inside which you are the vice president and I'm the clerk, and so on. When you organize a the house, you see.
Then you begin to speak in such terms that the speech, you see, puts everybody into his own, you see, righteous place. And when a husband begins to write to his future wife, he begins to ascribe to her the future place he wants her to have in his life. You assign rights to her to listen about certain things. You will be silent about other parts of your life. The more such things you do not mention, the more she will be excluded from these parts. Every marriage is different in this. There are people who are very well married and yet the husband never speaks of his business to his wife. There are others where every sorrow and every worry, you see, immediately is communicated to the wife, because in this case, in one case, the household is so organized that both are in business, so to speak. One at the receiving end and the other at the doing end, or there is a separation and she has the children and the kitchen and the guests and the friends, and he has to get the money. That's usually in those cases where he isn't very interested in his business. When a good man is really interested in his business, I think he must feel that he doesn't love his wife if he excludes her from all his experiences in this business. But as I said, there's no rule about this. What I mean to say is, whenever you love, you organize a unit inside which you and the beloved person have a certain role from now on, a certain function. And you do this by every word you speak. You just pave this road, you beat the trail. This is how we build roads, gentlemen. We don't build roads by macadam, we don't build roads by all these cementing and so on. The real roads in humanity lead by our speaking to certain people about certain things and to other people about other things. You go to a doctor and he becomes a doctor because some people go regularly to him and tell him about their diseases. So he becomes an expert on physical disease. No other way in which he can become a doctor, really, you see. And so you speak to me, you see, on certain abstract problems of philosophy or religion, you see, and on it goes. But you never see this, gentlemen. You always get stuck with what is said. The main problem of the fourth degree of life, gentlemen, is who speaks to whom? That's the important thing. Who is introduced to whom? The very beautiful word introduced, gentlemen. How can he be introduced to each other if not something opens up between you and me so that we have something in common now? Introduction means that this skin and my skin go, you see, and we suddenly are operated in such a way as though you would put a test tube unit from one end to the other. There is a connection to you. A conjugation, an alliance, or whatever you, convention, association, whatever words you use, gentlemen, it means that when we are introduced to each other, we are really introduced into each other. That is, we are inside of each other from now on. You can't get out of the system anymore after you really have met a person. Introduction is a very stupendous word, because we are introduced to each other in such a way that we grow into each other. The Greeks, when they spoke of handshake, they said one man's hand grew into the other man's hand. They fed this organic process, you see, by the handshake. It was like a tree taking root in the palm of the other. Which is a very right idea. The handshake in this country still has a little bit of this, you see, has a bit of this power, that something special has then happened. Otherwise, you don't shake hands. So I have tried to build up this whole fourth sphere, gentlemen, from its upper roof. From how it organizes organic processes into name people, what you call sex, but by affection and love, stoop down into organic life and use it to overcome death. But gentlemen, now you can see clearly that the relation which work has to dead matter, to things, is exactly the same relation that love has to organism. By work we incorporate dead matter into life, we said, remember? By manufacturing, by operations, my workshop. I put what we call production. The whole production line uses dead matter, metal and wood, etc., paper, and brings it into your and my life. Now, love making, which of course leads to the procreation of the human race and procreates beyond corpses, life, does the same with organic substance. By love, we incorporate organisms that otherwise die, you see, into the life everlasting of the race. That is, every love process sets free in you and me those substances, the sperm, that outlives you and my death, you and my passing, transient existence. If you see the parallel, you see what a cloud before our eyes is, because most people cannot discriminate these things. If you read the Kinsey report, he thinks sex is work. He actually does. They all do. Do you know what Mrs. Kinsey said when the interviewer came to her? And they said, "Where's Mr. Kinsey? We'd like to interview him." "Oh," she said, "since he has taken up sex, he never comes home at night." And any living organism, gentlemen, can live. He doesn't have to be incorporated into a working machine. But he must die. He must die. And love is that process that overcomes death. That is the great hymn in the New Testament and the Old Testament, in the Song of Songs, that love is as strong as death. That's nothing, gentlemen, to be looked away from or to be fooled with. It is tremendous. Where there is love, you can save the United States from decay, or you can save the human race from decay. Whatever love does is it perpetuates life. It renews life, which otherwise is, you see, dying. So dead things are incorporated by work because they have no life and by purpose. But living things can only be kissed into the victory over death by love. And the first thing, therefore, that is to open them up so that they volunteer their life force into some lasting unit. That's why courtship, gentlemen, is the most important chapter in love, and not the sexual act at the end, which is only of any use if it leads to this fruitfulness. By their fruits you shall know them, gentlemen. That is the important rule of the fourth commandment. Any sex process has only meaning and is only a blessing for the people who perpetrate it if it is fruitful. That's why I think the Catholic Church has a very great point by saying that you cannot know beforehand that your love affairs must remain fruitless. You sterilize your love. It isn't that you have to have children, gentlemen, but you must allow it to grow. The problem is no purpose. All this Planned Parenthood, or this artificial insemination, and so to me, is against the very character of this whole sphere of love. Love is taking the risk of bearing fruit. Taking the risk of being transformed. He who allows himself to be called by a name of love, or he who speaks to somebody else in love, gentlemen, is ready to be transformed. Not to remain who he is today, but to find himself dragged and drawn and chased and lifted or debased into a new formation. Amen. After you have loved for 30 years, you are a different person, gentlemen. When Goethe married his little friend, who was certainly a very minor matter at first in his life, he wrote a very wonderful poem. He became very serious. He married her finally after 17 years. It's a very great story how this poet of love discovered love, or rediscovered love, after he had lived for 10 years in complete abstinence in an idealistic friendship with the famous Frau von Stein. He discovered that he had done violence to his full nature, and he gave up this idealistic and really monastic vow. From 1778 to 1788, he was exclusively the the true lover of the Pope and Stein. That's for men in the, of great power and vigor and incredible power. He was a secular monk. And then he turned around and turned to this little girl and lived with her as husband, first as lover, as was his mistress. And he finally married her, and he finally wrote in justification of this rather astounding step to his friend Schiller a very great poem on this extramarital relation, in which he compared himself to an oak tree overgrown by ivy, and he said that the ivy finally would pull down the oak. It was so heavy, it was completely overgrown. But as his blood and his life and his energy flew freely into this ivy and took away from his own mighty growth, he says, he who trusts love, let me say it in German first, but because it's a good verse, wer sich der Liebe vertraut, hält der sein Leben zu Rat. Who he trusts love, can he economize with his life? That's impossible, gentlemen. Love is life into the second power. Love is life to the second power. And we have here, two is life to the first power, and this is literally true. You can follow it through all your mathematics and your logic. Love is life to the square. It means it is that power which can produce life. And we will see that this fifth sphere, gentlemen, is love to the square. Or life to the third power, to the cube. And this is not Rodemann, this is of course known to the New Testament or to Goethe or to these people, but you all laugh at these things. So you love, life, spirit are all just words somewhere in the corner. Gentlemen, there's a very strict order in the universe that matter, life, love, spirit are related to each other like the single power and the square and the cubic power. If you don't know this, you become very, very unhappy. You all become the part of the slaves of spirits whom you do not recognize for what they are. What's McCarthy? The absence of a spirit that comes out of love must always lead to the obedience under a spirit of hate. Because without spirit, no meditation can live. And so we have to hate if we cannot love. And since in this country, the spirit and the inspiration are forbidden, you have this division of mind and body, and you have organization, and you have work, and all these things. Therefore, you will always have crazy, and you will always have Ku Klux Klan, because hatred must take the place of the self. Because it is senseless, or it's a foolishness. Now, at this moment, I'm only driving at this simple fact, or not simple fact, but the fact which I recommend to your insight, that love is life to the square. It is not inside life, gentlemen. It is not a part of life, as you like to think. It's not a nice experience in life. The fourth sphere is as comprehensive, gentlemen, as all the other spheres, the whole sphere of work. You can see that production is a mighty thing. Your offices are a mighty thing. Your schedules and your budgets and your tariffs and your commissions and your committees. And you will admit that's the whole world, the world of production. It's very hard for me to tell you the idea that the world of passion, the world of life begetting passion, organizes the whole universe also in a special way, right through. That just as you can look at everything from the standpoint of the producer, you can also look at everything from the standpoint of the creator, from the artist, from the man who loves, and then the producer gets a very low position, and rightly so, and he has to be checked by, and in this country doesn't. Everybody overrides the producer in this country. You know that gets his laughter. My colleagues sit 8 hours in their business offices because they think business is the only way of life. The whole college community, gentlemen, in America is absolutely indebted to business for setting the standards of education. Now, gentlemen, I move with education in the fourth sphere, and that is without any time schedule. Where you have love, gentlemen, you have no hours. You have no hours. You can, when I prepare myself for this lecture, gentlemen, that cannot be measured by yardstick.
This is nonsense. You cannot figure out how long it takes for me to prepare this lecture, don't you see this? I had only 6 or 6 years before I was able to tell you these things, that I'm not going through with work.
When I came here, a friend of mine, a very methodical lady, asked me if I had found enough books in the library here.
Heavens, I said.
My whole problem is in order to teach you to forget sufficient, to forget enough. I must know less while I'm teaching you than I know, not more. But that's impossible for a business viewpoint, for the men in the third sphere. You think more is better. Gentlemen, I can't tell you. Imagine what I have omitted here. I haven't plagued you with any of the seven sacraments of the Christian Church, not with the dogma. I've been talking all the time about religion, aren't we? But I never mention any of the things I know. That is, I know outside the context of what you really can at this moment understand. This is the problem. So, in the sphere of love, gentlemen, less is more. In the sphere of business, more is more. All artistry is omission. People have said the great piece of art, what is it? Omission. A great artist shows you, like Rembrandt, shows you some shades and some light, and that's a great picture. And the photographer who works his head off with the best Leica, with the best lens, shows everything. Versus. And interesting. Now, no art, no creation, because no selection. Gentlemen, love is selection. And he who loves is selective. He's not only selective in the choice of his girl, but also in what he speaks to his girl. And also in what he allows her to read. He doesn't want her to read all the trash. He doesn't love the girl more by who gives her 10 subscriptions to 10 different magazines. He loves her most who says, don't read any of them. They aren't good enough for you. That's selection. Now the whole race, gentlemen, as you know, lives by selectivity. Darwin wrote a famous book, The Selection of Species, isn't he? But you have never thought what selection is. Selection is the power to ignore quantity. That's selection. A donor has to say, I have 50 girls, I want to have them all. A lover says, 50 girls? No, not interested. Not interested at all. One. One is more than 50. You can't understand this. But I only want to announce, gentlemen, that you are utterly blind to this fourth sphere because you haven't discovered your power of being selective. And you aren't proud of it. You have no philosophy of selectivity. You actually, when you think with your lower mind, think that more is better. The old Heraclitus of Ephesus, who was perhaps the greatest thinker the Greeks ever had, said, if the people could get their wishes fulfilled, they wouldn't be better off. This is set against the third sphere, where the people think the more they want, the better off they are. Now, any real person knows that his wishes are very minor matter, that God obviously has reason and provides the much better answer for his real needs. You see, that there are his opportunities, not what he thinks of, what he would like to have in his saving account, or in his wherever it is. It's a very good lesson, gentlemen. If all your wishes could be fulfilled, you would not be better off. Because it would stifle your power of selectivity. Wishes are all on wishy-washy. I mean, they are all without the strenuous forcefulness of selection. What are wishes? They are all on the same plane. I mean, here you see, I wish a dish of caviar or lobster, and there you wish to have friends, and then you wish to have riches. Gentlemen, that's no selection, because you are never forced to say what comes first. Now, love teaches you what comes first. Organization makes everything of equal importance. If you see the list of your sense of marks in the English department, these 54, they appear there because they are organized, all 54, in one of the, as being of the same importance.
gentlemen, I believe so. Will you take it, gentlemen? Neither the first nor the second nor the third sphere has any criterion for of importance. They must say everything is of equal importance. Love is the only power that is selective, and to be selective means to know what is important. And all things are less important than the thing that has to be done now and first. As a politician will always tell you, this bill is good and this bill is good, but the first thing is that I have to be elected. Because otherwise all these bills are of no, not the slightest interest to me, because I can't do anything about them. So you first elect me and later you see what laws you will pass. That's selective. This man is highly selective with regard to his own person. He knows that the only important thing is to elect him. In the Apricot by Bernard Shaw, there is such a wonderful line, the King of England, you know, the Emperor of America, it was also called the British Commonwealth. Who has read it, the Apricot, by Bernard Shaw? You have? You know what it is? Who knows? It's totally forgotten. Gentlemen, still very much in the making. Bernard Shaw, 30 years ago, predicted that the United States one day would annex England, create the British Commonwealth. We are in the process of doing just that, as you know. And we already have stolen Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and on it goes. And we do more. Now we are just annexing Egypt at this moment. And we call it, of course, anti-imperialistic policy. And and exactly in the same line of our anti-imperialistic policy and our great contempt for the British Empire, which we wish to inherit, Bernard Shaw said the Americans are going to sell the British this idea of annexation by saying, oh, the President of the United States from now on will have the title Emperor of America, in deference to the British monarchical ideas, you see. But we'll elect the Emperor every 4 years, but we call him Emperor. And, well, it's a good joke, but the main point is the King of England then receives one demagogue and the other political leaders of the country at his castle, and the demagogue is very nasty and says the king is no good, of course, and so the king says, well, sir, if you want me to dissolve the house, if you want to have a new election, all right, if I do it, what are you going to tell the electorate what to do? It's David, it's a little bit after Lloyd George, you know, David Lloyd George. And so David says, well, I tell the people to elect me. That's his whole policy, you see. So this is selectivity. But if you can make persons love you, they will elect you. That's a funny thing. Elections, gentlemen, come from selectivity. You always forget this. Election does not come from an arbitrary crowd, but it is from your standard of whom you wish to select. And forget the rest. That is, it is a positive measure, selection. And it is perfectly indifferent to quantity. In this country, you cannot win when you say that you are not interested in quantity. And yet everybody should be convinced, gentlemen, that quantity is very second best. Because even when you elect quantity as your most important thing, you still do the selective. You can, of course, say you elect quantity, but it is your selection of your value. And without it, quantity wouldn't win with you. But you are giving up surrender to quantity as though it was the only deity. And that is the third degree deity and not in the fourth. And so what you have to recover is the fact that you once made the decision in this country that mass production and quantity were the best thing for America. I believe it is. Your contribution of America has been in mass production. But because it has been in purposive mass production, gentlemen, you must still recover your power to decide that you made the decision that mass production is the best. Thank you.
Mass production is not the best. But you have selected to say that it is. That's a different story. Because that means that you can also regulate the selectivity and say it is not better to have 7 wives instead of 1. And you can have, therefore, a different divorce rate. And you can have a different legislation. But today, as I said, if my colleagues don't sit 7 or 8 hours in their office, they have a bad conscience. And if a man doesn't get a divorce, he has a bad conscience. Because they feel it is better to be married twice. It's more interesting, obviously, than to be married once. I assure you, it is much more interesting to be married once. It is very miserable to be married twice and very poor to be married thrice. That's an emergency. It can happen. I don't know. But to say the quantitative yardstick just breaks down in this case, doesn't it? To be married once is preferable to be married many times. Why that is so is very hard to say, gentlemen. It just means that it is a more fruitful love, the one marriage. Because it shows, by standing up 40 or 50 years, that it's very rich. That is full of qualities still to be developed, that you have such an imagination that you can whip up a souffle, omelette souffle every day out of your married life over 50 years. Whereas a man who has to get married 3 or 4 times, like all these rich playboys, they are just boring, there's nothing in their head. So they have to go in the outside world and find a new face to be interested at all. The selectivity, gentlemen, taps unheard energies in the smallest atom, in the smallest quality. But imagination has been forbidden in this country. You don't allow your imagination even to take place, so to speak, because you don't write poetry. Or you write poetry, this is not poetry, these are short stories. Or you write, a young woman of mine, of our acquaintance, came very close to committing suicide. And for some reason or other, I was able to rescue her from this despair. And of course, she was very grateful, and we became great friends. And after this great crisis in her life, she went to the unfortunate place called Rutgers. And there, one day, she was asked to write a paper. And she managed, with very good taste, I dare say, to write down this experience of hers, that this had a fruition and how this came out of it. And she received back this paper, which was a real confession and a real victory, with the signature of the professor and the one remark, saleable. Saleable. If I had been the father or the mother of this girl, I would have demanded from her to leave this hell immediately. To that low education has fallen in this country. That a young woman who tells a personal story in a paper is then lauded, is then praised because she could sell this to the Saturday Evening Post. There you have the complete confusion of all the spheres. Can you see this? It's a very simple example of what happens when you mistake one sphere for the other. What should you do with such a... Please, is this really an issue, ladies and gentlemen? This is death. It's a death warrant under the soul of this young woman. And it happens in a college of such standing. It's famous. Harvard has $365 million endowment. And for this very reason, probably, it is right under its syllabus. It's a crime. Can you see that it's a crime? I mean, I would debate it. You would like to debate it. But this is a crime. This is not a response, you see, to the honest word of a young woman. And she didn't write it in this trust that in an educational process you might be, you see, become personal. Let me try today to say one word about the richness of the fourth sphere. As in other spheres, as we have seen, work and play, sleep and deep sleep, speed and just imperishability of the material. So we have a split in the sphere of Venus. You can go more to the courtship and more to the fruitfulness. You can worship the mother and you can worship the bride. You can say that the beginning, the great passion, the love poetry is all, or you can say that the fruitfulness is all, the result of love. So you can have the family, so to speak, you see, all the lovers adorn. And there is therefore for you of great interest, gentlemen, today is a great controversy in America whether we have matriarchy or not. Now, there is a total misunderstanding about the use of the word matriarchy, and it all has to do with the proper division of the fourth sphere into really A and B. You can today say that the women in this country play a very important and prominent part, more important than the men. They have more money, they have more opportunity, they have more privileges, we have to get up when they have no seat and so on. They don't get up when we have no seat. But there is, in the word mother itself, especially in the word young mother, there has crept in a terrible misunderstanding. A woman of 20 can physically give birth to a child and yet be still a very attractive person. But a mother, in the sense of Mother Mary in the Catholic Church, she should not be called because she is just old enough to physically give birth to a child, but only if she has the moral and spiritual standards of, let's say, a woman of 40. That is, in the word mother, there are two different, quite different situations today contaminated or confused. The spiritual maturity of a woman, which only comes in her second half of life, and her attractiveness as a woman, which then is covered up by mother, matriarchy, but it really means just a young woman for whom you then have responsibilities because she has given birth perhaps to your own child, so you can't run away from her. But a 20-year-old girl is still just a 20-year-old girl. Her merely giving birth to a child, it may exalt your respect for her and your care for her, but it doesn't give her any spiritual authority in affairs of love. Now, with the word matriarchy, we however mean that the highest goods of the country, the religion, so to speak, the arts, culture, civilization, politics, are in put in the hand. This has been done in civilization with the proviso that these women were mature. And in the word matriarchy, as I hear it in this country, you see, there is no requirement, no standard of maturity implied for the women. If they were, if they had to, so to speak, if they were tested like a soldier, a veteran, it would be a different story. But you, as you know, the mothers of America and the daughters of the revolution and the spinsters of the revolution, all they enjoy a tremendous reputation regardless of the content of experience in love affairs, which this should really imply. And therefore I, at this moment, at first, from the American viewpoint, would suggest that we make a difference, not so much to clear this up, between the bride, the Aphrodite, and on the one hand side, and the great mother of sex on the other. The word great mother is an ancient expression. The Asiatic people had the great mother of Pessinus, Sibylle, and she returns in St. Paul's letter to the Acts, the story of Paul in Ephesus, you know, when the goldsmith cried, "Great is the Diana of Ephesus." That is really the great mother, who is protecting mankind by her householding, by her wisdom, by her experience. And these two goddesses, then, gentlemen, have to be, this should be discriminated. What you call Venus, or I did call Venus, you may not never call it this way, or what you call love in general, really means the first half of the love relations, the seed, not the fruit. Be on your toes yourself, and you must see there are two reasons for expressing the relations, this whole world of affectionate and passionate relations, from two sides, from the aspect of its results and from the aspect of its
starting, of its getting going, of its setting out, adventuring into a new human relations sentiment. You are you can only sanctify your own love relations or sex relations if you make this distinction. A man must remain spiritually superior to his young bride, gentlemen. You must be the quarter. And the mere fact that somebody is physically a mother does not invite anything but your tenderness or your caring for her. It has gives her no right to put you under her care, which is the implication of matriarchy. The right of a woman to be wise in counsel over you, so to speak, or in the counsel of the nation, would only come after she has borne responsibility for a large family and raised them, so to speak, so 20 years later. It's a crude way in which I have to express it, because we have killed all these relations in antiquity or in the Germanic tribes. The goddess of Freya, Freya, who gave the name to the moon day Friday, Venus, of course exemplified this higher wisdom of fulfillment, whereas Venus more exemplified the courtship. Anyway, we have lost all these names. To you, that's all just abstraction. I think it is in your own family relation, it's experience. You do worship certain elements of household in which only a good woman and a good grandmother, for example, can supply. If you take what the grandmother stands for and the mother together, sometimes the grandfather, then you have a little bit of what I try to say, what a real matriarchy would be. People remove from immediate decisions that are equipped with the wisdom that people who in business also would not have, executives or fighters. But tested people. My main point is there is a motherhood or matriarchy which is based on tested life, on achievement, on being able to bring up these fruits of love into a new order and fulfilling the meaning of many. That is a grouping power. And it's the opposite, gentlemen, from organizational power. If you take great mother or great grandmother, a real grandmother, what is her great power? What is so astonishing? That every grandchild keeps its individuality, is utterly different from every other grandchild. I don't think a good grandmother will ever make the mistake of trying to coordinating all these grandchildren as though they were all the same brand or the same vintage. What parents cannot do, individualize, grandparents can do. Who would bear me out of this? Any experience? Who has the grandparents living? Well, don't you think they are more apt to let you free your own freedom than your parents? Isn't that true?
Isn't that a measure, though? The amount of freedom they would allow, is that what you said?
Well, that is, they trust more in that you have a life of your own, which cannot be, that doesn't have to be coordinated so that it jives with everybody else's life.
I say grandfather more than
that. Well, you're right. In that age, you see, the sex doesn't interfere. Grandparents are just quite, regardless of sex, you see, they are just your elders, that's all. I mean, grandparents and grandchildren have no sex relations. That is true. We have we are so impoverished, you see, that we always have to think of grandmother and grandfather. In many primitive tribes, at 50, the chief would just take foot on a woman's garb. That's why our priests wear a gown, you see, that's a woman's dress, and our judges wear robes, in order to show that as a judge, and as a chieftain, and as a doctor, and as a priest, you have no sex. And that's exactly the situation of any elder, any grandfather, you see. There is no sex relation. And again, this is all to destroy because you live by two generations only. You think in terms of old and gender. Life becomes only interesting when you think in terms of three generations, grandparents, parents, and children.
Any professional man, gentlemen, belongs to, is an elder in this society. And you become a lawyer at the age of 25, and you plead, and you have to examine Mrs. Shepherd or Mr. Shepherd. It is not obscene, because you have a gown. And if you are a good lawyer, there is no obscenity in your cross-examination. Although you have to delve in the derbies to see details of their personal life. Can you see this? We have found means and ways of putting even a young person into the garment of an elder so that he is treated as though, so that he can behave as though he was a grandfather. Now I'm trying to build up and use this notion again, that this word matriarchy I only is a starting point to show you that you have foreshortened this whole sphere of form. As soon as the fourth sphere consists only of young people who make love to each other, or of parents and children, it's too short. It's too, the real relation, gentlemen, in the sphere of affection is always between three generations. And the matriarchy of which I'm willing to speak seriously would be one which includes grandmother. But I'm not willing to talk to give the honor to a matriarchy just because somebody has married somebody and then now deals before his wife because she has been good enough to go to bed with him. As so many American boys seem to do, because they are so overcome by the goodness of this woman. But that is no spiritual authority, gentlemen. That isn't good enough. You have to have more. You have to see the whole width of life. And wherever somebody has gardened the many fruits of love, like a grandmother, and has allowed every one of these creatures to be a species of their own, there you have the right rule. Because in the sphere of love, gentlemen, you do not organize. But as love selects, so the fruits of love, gentlemen, what are they? They are not organized, they are recognized. This is the great thing why a speaker in the Congress has to be recognized by the President pro tempore of the Senate. Recognition means to leave everybody in his own way. Organization means to do away with everybody's personal character. Now, your parents must make short trips if they have seven children, they have to organize the family in some way, otherwise they don't get by in time. But your grandparents, they can allow themselves to recognize you. Can you see the difference? Would this be agreeable to you, this term? Do you understand the difference? Parents are hard put to recognize the difference between their children. But grandparents are not, that's what they, the whole business. Any elder, gentlemen, has this privilege over the fighters and the breadwinners and all these gentlemen, these successful executives and these smart addicts, that they can recognize people for what they are. They can recognize people. And nobody seems to be, we are too much in a hurry, you and I, you see, to recognize people. We want to get by and say, there's 10 students, I've met 10 students from Princeton. You know, can you recognize them? Not one of them. They're just a classmate. Whereas an old man who meets them, he, even an old farmer here, he meets two boys and he very well just recognizes one for what he is and the other for what he is not. So the very word recognition has to do with allowing the man to have his own name. That's recognition. Allowing a person to have his own name. And all fruitfulness of life, gentlemen, leads to this, that we recognize that every one of us is a species of his own. And for this we have a special group of people, the elders. And they do not occur in the third sphere, because in the third sphere you go by quantity. Now, a man who is selective perhaps cannot work hard. But you can't do without Secretary of the Stimson or Knox, the two secretaries who led the war, as you know, as Republicans in the Democratic cabinet to success. They were great old fellows, and they had this power of recognition. If you read Mr. Stimson's descriptions and characteristics, that was his outstanding description. He was 78 when he entered the cabinet of the war cabinet, you see, in 1940. And he certainly was, and Hull the same way, by the way, Mr. Hull.
and they had this power as old men, that they only moved in sphere four. They didn't care for organizing work. That was their business, you see. For this you have Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson is exclusively in the third sphere. That's why he made this funny doggle mark, you see. That could have, had to happen to a man who only can organize labor or work. It's nothing bad against the man, but he just has never lived in the fourth sphere. He doesn't know what that is. So he can't speak the language which a worker wants to hear. You remember the great squabble at the during the elections. That's the difference between a politician gentleman and a businessman. That's why you shouldn't have businessmen in the cabinet. We should have political people because they can at least speak the language of affection and of recognition. The businessman can only speak the language of regulations and of organization and of production. And that's not the language with which you bring people together. So now I wish you a very good Thanksgiving. That said, with the selectivity for the turkey.